Hi everyone, you're listening to Tech Traction and we are your hosts, Zameer and Niranjan. Joining us today is Dr. Robby Murphy, who is the Raytheon Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at Texas A&M University. She is also the Director of the Humanitarian Robotics and AI Lab, which is now a non-profit organization. Dr. Murphy is the founder of Roboticists Without Borders. She is also the founder of the Fields of Rescue Robotics and Human-Robot Interaction. She has done pioneering work in the use of robotics for disaster management. She inspired innovative methods of using science fiction for teaching artificial intelligence and robotics.
Her area of research primarily focuses on artificial intelligence for mobile robots as applied to disaster robots. This study fundamentally covers human-robot interaction, autonomy, dimensionless numbers, and metrics for capturing field performance. She is the recipient of the 2014 Eugene L. Lawler Award for Humanitarian Contributions within Computer Science and Informatics. She has received many other awards in recognition of her humanitarian work. Welcome, Dr. Murphy. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Why, thank you for having me here, and what a lovely introduction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Murphy. So without further ado, let's begin with the question. What are some challenges people face when interacting with robots? Can these problems interfere with disaster rescue operations?
Well, it's really interesting about how people interact with robots. So it turns out that for ground robots, they interact like they do with people. So they subconsciously interact with a robot the way it does a person or a dog or an animal. So if you get too close for your culture, you know, that somebody's in your face, you don't like the robot to do that. If the robot's erratic, you're kind of thinking maybe it's kind of like a rabid dog or something. It's unnatural. So we can, and that's called the computers as social actors paradigm, some work that was started by Clifford Nass at Stanford. It's held up very well. What's really interesting is it doesn't hold for aerial vehicles. And that may be because, you know, whereas we've always been eaten by lions and tigers and bears, we haven't been eaten, you know, evolutionary wise by eagles or bees. You know, they're annoying, but they don't really come down. They're not a major threat. So we, Dr. Brittany Duncan, her thesis was all about how people were letting these quadcopters get right up to their face. And it's like, no, those are blades. I mean, those can cut your eyes out or in some cases cut your throat and cause you to die. And people were not showing the right kind of proxemic distancing effect that they would with a ground robot. So we don't know how it is. But let me give you a third case. What we're seeing is that going back to that idea of social action interactions, in Italy, they've been using the Tommy robot. And it's a very professional looking robot. It's commercial. It looks like a small child that comes in. It's got a face, but the face is a screen, and it can bring in a tray and start doing some visual diagnostics teleoperated by the healthcare professionals. Well, let's think about who is affected by COVID the most. Elderly people. So somebody, a grandmother in her 80s, who is now very sick and disoriented, alone in a hospital bed, and you have a robot roll in. Hated it. No, this was not. What are we doing? And time again, they found the seniors were just like, nope, we're not doing this. So very interesting to see that these things are in fact important.
Thank you, Dr. Murphy. That was really interesting. So, moving on, our next question is about the recently popular Rocco Basilic thought experiment. This thought experiment helps understand the basic risks behind developing AI. The premise is that an all-powerful artificial intelligence from the future could retroactively punish those who did not help bring about its existence sooner. What are your views on this?
I think it's a wonderful episode for Black Mirror. I'm not sure it's really relevant as an AI researcher, okay? You know, I'm a person, I should punish you for my parents for not having me sooner. What? No. Do we even build things that way? What was purposeful? And then we've got the whole thing about general AI. So no, that's just too fanciful.
No, that is, it is comforting to know that. Yeah. Coming back to the present, people could also eventually lose their jobs to AI and robotics. Is this fear justified? What is your take on this?
Yeah, and that's a real concern. We have historically not seen as much job loss replacement from robots being it as we have seen displacement, where, yeah, you lost these jobs here, but so many jobs were created over here. Now, if you're the person who lost their job, the displacement over here is not necessarily a good thing, right? Because you've lost your job. But for society as a large, there's often a net gain. So that's a tough one. Now, if we look at what's happening with COVID, we're not seeing most of the applications for using robots. We're involve replacing people. We're seeing robots being used for public safety, for healthcare, for clinical care. We're seeing them used, and I'm going through an order of which the frequency of reports, public safety is kind of fascinating that public safety is higher, more frequently used than clinical, but clinical quality of life and continuity of work and education. And then we see laboratory automation for all the medical supply chain. And then we see non-hospital care, like the quarantine camps or nursing homes or assisted living, which have a different set of regulations and economic motive, you know, the way that hospitals are run. Well, if you start looking at that, what you're seeing is that, first off, robots are there to be the ultimate in personal protective equipment. We use robots to let us work with people remotely or even in the next room without having to don PPE, wasting PPE, and without having to risk yourself of exposure because nothing's perfect. So you're seeing all of these types of things. The predominant number is with teleoperation or some sort of shared autonomy where the person doesn't want to be out of the loop. They don't want to delegate the robot. They want to interact with the patient. They want to interact with people, and it's enabling them to do it more effectively or more safely. Now, there are things that are delegated. One of the great uses of robots, the most frequent use of robots in hospital and clinical care, are disinfectant robots. Zoom, 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 into a room, with UVC light, clean that up. Somebody comes, wipes down the last bit, make sure anything, and then off we go. Things that you don't have enough people to handle the surge capacity in a hospital. Same thing, taking out the trash, bringing in, go get the meal carts. You don't want to have the robot try to give the meal cart to the person because, first off, they can't do it. But second, that's kind of a social event. But why waste everybody's time with routine stuff? So it's interesting to see things you delegate that nobody, but things that you want to do and enable the healthcare professionals in particular to be compassionate, to do what they got into healthcare for, which is to actually interact with patients. So that's been very rewarding to see that.
That is very nice to hear. So moving on to our next question. Disaster robotics is a pretty intriguing term, I must say. What made you pursue a career in this field?
So disaster robotics, the big year that the field was actually created in 1995. And 1995 was a terrible year. You had the Kobe earthquake and you had the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, there's lots of disasters in them, but those two disasters happened in the same year that everybody in robotics, in AI robotics, was looking at making small robots to go to Mars. Everybody had, we were looking like, could you get three robots, small robots, or do you want to do one the size, of, eventually the size of Sojourner? Or you want to do five, or this, and smaller is better than this. And all of a sudden we looked and it was very clear that those same small robots that could handle these really unpredictable terrains and stuff would have been so valuable for the building collapses. and interacting, finding victims that are buried deeply in the rubble, that no one can get to them in time before they die, and finding them and locating them and interacting, that this was a good use for those small robots to put them into that kind of application. So Dr. Satoshi Todokoro at Kobe University and myself in the United States both independently started working in that area, transferring our work to that.
So could you elaborate on the type of robots used for such disaster rescue operations?
Yeah, well, it's land, sea, and air. So the first types of robots that were used for disasters were ground robots. And that kind of makes sense. You think of the building collapses, the earthquakes, things like that. And 9/11 was the first use, taking small robots that were being designed for small tactical operations for the military and transferring them to the use there. But let's not forget aerial vehicles. So the first use of small unmanned aerial systems, again, our group out of CRISAR was doing, was at Hurricane Katrina, a huge devastating. It is the tide for the, with Hurricane Harvey as the largest hurricane disaster in the United States. So using the UAVs to go and look and assess damage, I mean, you couldn't go anywhere. I mean, all the trees were down, all the roads were blocked. Mm-hmm. Well, rather than everybody trying to chainsaw, they pop up, look around. You know, we were sent in one area that was totally cut off, power was cut off, water, no idea how the people were doing, popped up, and it's like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about them. Someone has a big construction bulldozer, and they're bulldozing two houses out of the road. We're pretty sure they'll be able to take houses in the road, really. I mean, that was kind of an amazing photo. And then the tree, we know the trees aren't going to be a problem. So they're going to be back on. They're going to be able to get into civilization, and we can get goods and water through to them pretty soon, within 24 hours. So they don't need help. These people over here, okay, they're having trouble. So getting things like that was just really fascinating. But people often underlook water, both the what you can do from the surface of the water and underwater. So when you have a hurricane flooding, right? I mean, what a terrible problem. Look at all the flooding that's in China right now. So it's what happens to all your bridges? What happens to all your infrastructure? Same thing with the storm surge and the tsunami in Japan. What do you do with that? So having underwater vehicles, because there's only so many divers that are rated for diving in those very dangerous shallow littoral areas where under a bridge where there may be lots of debris may suddenly be washed down. The currents are usually very high because of all the water draining, unnaturally high, and the water's very turbid. So, I mean, basically you have to wait 6 months to get a couple of divers who just feel their way down the footing of the pilings of a bridge, and to see if anything underwater, if there's something broken or it's no longer in the ground, that's called scour. And that's something you can't do any other way. I mean, we were saying, oh yeah, we can use UAVs. And the Texas Department of Transportation kind of looked at me like I was a little crazy or a little slow. And they said, you know, we have binoculars. We can actually see above the waterline, but seeing underwater, we can't do that. So any ROVs, those kind of technologies are super. So that's something that people forget. And they also forget about the terrible marine mass casualties, like sinking ships and things like that, and the refugees coming through the Mediterranean. Lifeguards, coast guards, you can only get about one lifeguard can handle about three people in the water at one time. When you have a boat with 50, with 800 people, what do? So having little robot life jacket surfboards to hang on to get out to there, you go hang on to that while I, as a lifeguard, go deal with the person who's clearly drowning, or who is older, or who is a child, because they get hypothermia even in warm water. You got to get them out. And so letting the lifeguards do what they do best. So how exciting to think of all the ways that robots can be used I mean, mostly right now we hear a lot about drones because drones are cool. The quadcopters are so sexy and they're inexpensive and we can buy them. But there's just all these other ways to use them as well.
That was very informative. So concerning the recent aero explosion, are robots being currently used there to repair the city?
Which city?
Beirut, Lebanon.
I'm not aware of robots being used. And that was one of the ones that when the buildings and all of that collapsed, I was thinking, boy, I hope they know to get the types of ground robots to get back, particularly in the collaterally damaged buildings and houses. Because what we know statistically is that a dog can find a person or can get the scent that somebody's there, but they can't tell where. And they may be on the wrong side of the building because it's just how the airflow goes through. So you know somebody's there. Or in the case of the Algerian earthquake, you know everybody's in this apartment building and we're home watching the soccer game. So they're in here somewhere. But most of our tools are only good for about 2 to 3 meters, you know, a borescope, a camera on a stick. So having a robot with wheels that can kind of tracks, that can kind of claw their way in and go further to help locate where, because otherwise you're stuck just picking a corner and trying to excavate. And that means that you may not have, you know, people over here and you started there, you didn't get to in time. So hopefully they were using some of the pipe inspection robots, some of the small bombs inspection robots and things to do that. I know they were bound to have drones there, the quadcopter, you know, UAVs to help document and monitor.
So what is the success rate of such robots? Are they reliable enough to be entrusted with human lives?
Well, we don't normally keep track of try to say how many lives did they save, and one reason is that robots don't run into the building and bring out the burning building and bring out a baby. They're like fire trucks. They're like that search cam. How many cameras on a stick on a wand have saved lives? Well, I don't know, but they help the job go faster. They say, okay, there was nobody here, or this is low probability here, there's really this, or that. There's a really, it's not the metric that fire rescue teams use. Yeah, so they're certainly successful. They're getting used, which is the biggest metric of success.
And which disaster operation are you proudest of? In which event do you feel like you help make the most difference?
You know, there's so many different disasters, you know, starting with the big ones, 9/11, Hurricane Harvey. So let's take Hurricane Harvey as an example, right? That was tied for the second largest hurricane disaster in the United States. Huge. And Houston, we were working, we ran the UAV response for one of the suburb counties, Fort Bend County, which is the western, southwestern suburb area and rural area with there. Well, first off, we let them, we enabled the Office of Emergency Management to see what was going on. And they could also do things like, we know people are trapped in this neighborhood, but what's the best way to get in? Do we put the boats up here, or do we put them over here, or do we put them in there? What, which way, if once we get the boats in, are the trees down and power lines down that we can't go there? You know, let's speed this up. Okay, so that's one thing to look at. Another thing is looking at, does a big use was, is the water behaving the way the flood models predict it to be? Because you need to know, if not, is there some sort of natural dam of debris that we need to go blast out so we can get the drainage back? Is it worse than what's predicted? We need to know what those rising levels are, how that impacts people, what that does that mean to our levees and dikes, you know, and even the dam, what, you know, how does that impact it? It also let them estimate do two other things that are very subtle. One is it started letting them estimate how much water was in each neighborhood. And the reason that that's important, so first off, they knew it was going to be a federally declared disaster. I mean, you've got a couple of photos and you're like, yes, this meets the criteria. There's a quantitative number that you reach and you say, yep, you automatically get certain funds. All right, but the rest is, okay, how much has this house been flooded? Because if the house only been flooded half a meter, then that's a certain level of damage. But if it's flooded a meter or a meter and a half, all of the sheetrock has to be ripped out of the first floor. All of the carpets will have to come out. All of the electrical has to come out. If you've had just half a meter, you've lost your washing machine, your refrigerator. Well, why do we care? Because you've got to put all of that on the curb, and then the county has to haul it away. But how much you haul away and how you get charged depends on how, if it's refrigerators and washing machines versus carpets and draperies versus wooden furniture and things like that. So you have to go sort it out. And this let them go ahead and get a head start on getting those contracts in place. So as soon as the water, they already had dump trucks lined up to start taking the waste out. It still took well over a month to do, but they got it. And some of the other areas that were affected that didn't, you know, that waited till the water was done and then they did the estimates, they had to wait over a month to even start because all of the dump trucks were committed to the ones that the cities and counties that were first, that thought of it first and made the deals first. And then one of the major cities in the western part of Texas lost all of their recycling. The big recycling company there with the big recycling trucks said, no, we're going to break our contract and go because there's more money cleaning up from Harvey. You'll get us when we come back. We know you'll hire us back, but they need us more. And it was true. I mean, you know, recycling versus the vermin and the rats and the mold and the health effects and the fact that nobody can move back into their house once you get that all cleaned up. So it was pretty funny. Anyway, sorry, that was long.
Yeah, no, that was really insightful, actually.